Just a little taste of Denise Vasquez's very unique song, which I absolutely adore, Pipe Dream. And you can check it out at denisevasquez.com. And I'm sure you'll love it. It's from her album that came out a while back, one of her best albums I've ever heard, called Frame of Mind. And of course, this is Andrew Fetter with When Pigs Fly. And I want to thank you all out there for listening and have listened and will listen. Again, thank you all. God bless you all. I feel honored because I have a very, very special guest before I have him come on. I have just a brief announcement. For those who are living within the Los Angeles area, I have started doing some readings. And I've been again doing those on Sunday, Monday, and Wednesday. That's in the Sherman Oaks store of the Psychic Eye bookstore. You can call in at 818-906-8263, schedule an appointment, Sunday 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., Monday 4 p.m. to 10 p.m., and Wednesday 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. Also, I've been asked, and I feel honored actually to do this. I was planning to do this for a while, but I have to admit, I'm going to be doing a class for Kabbalah, and it's the Practical Kabbalah. I will be starting this class on September 15th, which is a Thursday. There are going to be 7 classes, and I will be teaching Practical Kabbalah and Esoterics. And it's at the same store, it's like an iBookstore in Sherman Oaks. What will be in case is to develop and heal oneself with a greater self-worth and self-love, along with a greater understanding of the universal love and joy. It will help broaden the utilization of the universe and God's love that is infinitely around, which transcends from individual to all humanity. It will develop a keen awareness and a deeper understanding of the wisdom held within our infinite universe and its endless capacity. My class will include the teaching of very fundamentals of the essence of real Kabbalah, including spiritual concepts and relating to healing, guides, karma, which is often called in Hebrew tikkun, life and death, dreams, out of body, which is the Merkabah, and relations to the Merkabah, and reincarnation, and of course meditation, and other metaphysics held within the path of Kabbalah. So do check that out for those who are in the LA area. There will be limited capacity, since we have a finite room, so there will be finite room to do a class. I will keep it at a limited, therefore I will be able to deal with each person one-on-one with their questions and utilizations, because this is a practical form. It's not just actually, you know, learning theology of it just generalities of Kabbalah. Now, I have a very, very special guest. He has been been interviewed by several from coast to coast, George Knapp, famous people who have dealt within the understandings of UFOs and extraterrestrial phenomena, or I don't say phenomena because they're really here. He has written an extraordinary book. Actually, I've just been going back and forth reading it, and I feel really quite honored to have him. His name is Colin Bennett, and he is author of Flying Saucers Over the White House, which deals with the inside story of Captain Edward, hope I pronounce his last name right, the Captain, Ruppelt, which is sort of a pretty famous person who was involved with the famous Blue Book, and deals with the true understandings of...
The introduction.
of the U.S. Air Force investigation of the UFOs. Cullen, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Am I loud and clear?
Yeah, how you doing? How's everything in the U.K. these days?
Yeah, right. So first, let me thank you for your invitation.
Oh, it's an honor to have you. I gather from reading this that you might just possibly, and I say this sort of sarcastically, that you have a greater knowledge of this. Is when you wrote this book, it looks like you have a very in-depth knowledge of the aeronautic history, along with understandings of the history of UFOs and extraterrestrials. Am I correct?
Yes, indeed. Yes, I follow military history. I write on military history, and I've done a lot of research in that direction for many years. And ufology, I've written two books on what you might call ufology, including one book on George Adamski.
Now, let me ask you this. After reading this book, now how do you pronounce his last name? I feel like an idiot when I pronounce Ruppelt. Is it Ruppel or Ruppelt? How do you spell it, pronounce his name? That's the captain who was, that was part of the, or head of the Blue Book area, maintaining inside the Air Force. How you pronounce his name? Ruppelt,
yeah, that's it, yes.
Now, after reading this, now, I was, like, not so shocked, but it was amazing. I felt sorry for the guy, to tell you the truth, because it seemed like he was very much of a very simple person, Joe Blow soldier, doing his duty, and he was very much passionate about his job. That's what it seemed like. And they basically put him through the meat grill when he just tried to do what he thought was correct. But what amazed me is how screwed up the military is when you read it, which just doesn't surprise me because I know the U.S. military. And I've heard stories of the same thing, like a lot of the military, especially the British as well, which I guess that's why they're so inclined brothers, I guess, that they are pretty, as much as they're bureaucratically inefficient. And I almost feel, because there's a, when we're all reading it, he goes through all this stuff that he is, doesn't, all this red tape, and it's like purposely to screw him up to get out information or access investigations, and it's a quagmire within the Air Force. But then on the other hand, which I'm going to get into with the famous Washington thing down at the end of the show, 1952, but it seems like there's another side that was highly efficient, almost like a secret, like the CIA or another division that was highly efficient. So you almost had a dichotomy of two different areas, and I almost think the same thing is in the UK, that they have a screwed up military, but when it comes to intelligence and the ones who really do shit, they got it down back what they do. Am I off target?
Yes, indeed. That you summed it very well, I'm here. Sorry, it's a bit faint. Am I loud and clear?
Yeah, I hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, fine. Well, Ruppelt was a bombardier navigator on the island of Tinian during the Second World War, and the island of Tinian housed the big B-29 groups, which were preparing for the invasion of Japan. Ruppelt, as a person, was always involved unwittingly with great historical events. First, he could, as an airman on Tinian, have seen Enola Gay take off for Hiroshima with the first nuclear weapon abroad. And a few days later, Boxcar, another B-29, took off for for Nagasaki. He could have seen both those aircraft take off. And in fact, if there'd been an accident or influenza aboard the B-29 cruise, Ruppelt might well have been chosen to take the place in Boxcar or in Olegay. When you brush history so closely, you don't forget it.
So he was actually, was he a bombardier or actual?
Yes, a bombardier navigator.
All right, that's what I thought. See, what's really great, which I didn't understand in the book, how did he jump from, it was just out of promotion, how did he jump from being a bombardier into a bureaucrat? That's what I was sort of curious, because usually...
Well, just after, he was an enlisted man, and after the war, he joined the aircraft industry, for which he was well qualified. And this carried on for a couple of years until the Korean War came along, and he was re-enlisted and sent to ATIC at Wright-Patterson Air Base, Dayton, Ohio. ATIC was Air Technical Intelligence Command. And he had his original rank of captain. At ATIC, he was given the task by Colonel Rosengarten to examine a captured, or I think it was crashed rather than captured, MiG-15. The MiG-15 was giving the American fighter pilots quite a problem in Korea. Am I loud and clear?
Yeah, that's correct. I remember, I'm aware that because at the time, the U.S., wasn't looking for a fighter as the most engaging on combat one-on-one. They thought the future was more of keeping a very distance of attacking instead of close tactics, which they turned out to be very incorrect. So the Soviets, from what I remember, because of my history of aeronautics, the Soviets were actually in the early 50s a lot further ahead as far as combat fighter pilot technology or tactics, because the U.S. was focused on bombardiers or bombing missions and keeping, they thought eventually, you know, that's going to be way separate, their theology. People don't realize that actually the U.S., I hate to say it, not to pop people's bubbles on tactics of military, but the U.S. military tactics were really just I'll throw a whole billion bullets at you, more coming at you faster than you can produce bullets, and I'll win the war by producing more bullets and throwing them more at you. It was never really about any actual strategy on the ground for cutting through. It was just out of straight force. Even Patton was straight force. The Soviets and others had the Soviets used pretty much their same ideology. It was only the Germans and the Israelis and even the Vietnamese had to use strategic elements, including the Japanese also used strategic elements. Let me ask you this, because I don't want to get into that area of where he was in that, but now I understand, because I was sort of curious how he just basically was selected. Do you think he was purposely selected out of his naivety to be in such a position? Because it almost it was done on purpose. Do you think there are? Do you think because Ruppelt's naivety of being a gung-ho, I'm going to work for the Air Force, who had no clue what he was really getting into, that they actually selected him to put him in that position purposely to make things sort of to screw with what they think with the idea, the intelligence of dealing with UFOs and information gathering?
Well, first of all, it was a genuine post. He did actually analyze the MiG-15. While he was doing this, working at his desk at attic, he heard laughter, much laughter, from another desk of Air Force workers, three desks down. And they were laughing so much all the time in a very supercilious way. He curiously inquired about what this group of officers were laughing at. And he then, for the first time, heard the word flying saucer. They were getting reports of flying saucers and were laughing at them and throwing them into the rubbish bin. This inspired him to inquire a little about the work they were doing.
Oh, so that's so. Let me ask you this: so he, while he was under the intelligence, running the involved in the intelligence service in the Air Force, he then, while they are studying the Russian technology, aeronautic technology with the MiGs, that's where he got the information, seeing UFO stuff. But as then there were people were trashing that information, just laughing about like what you're saying. So it wasn't like I got the picture. Because I thought he was at first originally just put there to deal with the UFOs, but I see what you're saying. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
It was obvious that the UFO project then, called Project Grudge, was not being put on a proper basis. Colonel Rosengarten then chose another officer and a new project and retitled the project called New Grudge. This officer decided that Ruppelt would be a good part-time help because the work on the MiG-15 was winding down. And so Ruppelt was introduced to UFO analysis on a part-time basis and saw top-secret UFO reports, which Attic was compiling on a much better basis under this much more competent officer. After a while, Colonel Rosengarten decided to form a new project, completely new project, with extra staff, extra finance, and he put Ruppelt in charge of this. The project was called Project Blue Book, which was become famous as a UFO research faculty. Ruppelt willingly took up this offer and immediately put UFO studies on a scientific basis. He had extra staff, up to eight staff, and better finance. He gave material to the Battelle Institute to use their punch card analysis regarding flight characteristics, observer disposition, etc. That was the nearest you could get to computer analysis in those days. The punch card was a very good instrument, but nowhere near as good as the electronic computer, which had not yet arrived on the scene. Am I loud and clear?
Yeah, I hear you. Okay, I gotcha. So, let me ask you this. When he started doing all the investigations with the Blue Book, which is, everybody should just look that up down the line when you have a chance. But from what I gathered from reading in your book, a lot of that stuff was being, a lot of stuff as information was coming in was actually being destroyed, which I didn't understand. He was supposed to be in control of getting this information for investigations. Yet at the same time, I'm reading how they literally would destroy any evidence, you know, like destroy it. I mean, it would be a piece of paper and they would. So he didn't seem, that's why it almost looked like a joke. It looked like he was set up. That's why I'm asking you. I think from my feeling reading this book that he was set up as a patsy.
Well, perhaps hardly at first, but it became increasingly evident that there was enormous Air Force resistance to Project Blue Book. They didn't like it. And they put every obstacle in the way of Ruppelt's investigations. There were also much more sinister actions that occurred within the higher structures of the Air Force. Vandenberg, for example, in 1948, he was chief of staff of the Air Force, destroyed the report from Project Sign, which was possibly the very first official UFO investigation. The report was called "Report on the Situation," and it concluded that the UFOs were interplanetary. Now, Brigadier General Vandenberg didn't like this at all; thought it was a load of nonsense. But instead, this is intelligence information. And instead of storing it carefully, though he didn't like it, he destroyed it, destroying Air Force property, and led himself open to criminal charges. Another high-up officer, Colonel Watson, a war hero, destroyed the White Sands film and also a wire recording of the Cabell meeting on UFOs. So we have incredible, unbelievable opposition to the UFO from high-ranking officers, all of whom are stout men and true. They had both Watson and Vandenberg had 5 inches of medals on their chest. They were American patriots. They fought in the air.
Can I ask you a question, Colin? Because that was really bizarre. Because my question to you was the destruction of UF material, was it out of, let's see, just out of their own desire or their own, these individual officers' desire to just destroy it because they thought it was all crap? Or were they instructed by somebody else to go, hey, you know what, we want this thing capped? Do you understand what I'm saying?
There's a mystery here that's not been solved. Both officers risked court-martial. I don't know whether there's an American phrase for that. That's the British phrase, court-martial. Being dismissed from the Air Force for criminal acts, destruction of intelligence records, willful destruction. And someone on another phone-in suggested to me that it wasn't really criminal. The aliens told them to do it. And I said, well, to accept that premise, you have to accept what's now termed exopolitics. That's the view of Salah and Weber, that the aliens have always been here and they're helping to do things like clean up the Gulf oil spill. My reaction to that was, well, if the aliens are helping us to clean up the Gulf oil spill, they're not doing it very well.
Well, I was going to say to you, if they're instructed by, let's say, the an ex-president like Bush, who would say, hey, you know what, destroy this material because I don't want you to know the real reason why we went into the war of Iraq, and then they get a little slap on the hand, next thing you know, it's obstruction of justice, like Libby for getting involved with, what he committed was obstruction of justice with outing a CIA spy, with that famous case, and then doing so, they just said, okay, so we'll just give him a pardon, and it's basically doesn't matter. So a president can literally make it technically legal if they want to, or somebody else. That's why I was curious. Like, so you're saying, it's a destruction of governmental property. Yeah, all fine and dandy, but look at all the oil companies and all the things that are done illegally. Look how many laws that were broken just from our last president. I'm not even talking about this president. And they don't do, who's going to say anything to them, but they'll get the same obstruction of justice or a track star saying that they lied or obstructed justice for taking hormones or whatever, and they'll throw her in jail. So that's why I'm thinking that there was something my question to you was, what is your feeling? Do you think it was just their own personalities who are these individual officers thought that was the UFO stuff was crap and they just want to dump it and they didn't believe it? Or were they ordered to dump it? That's my question. Were they taking orders from somebody else outside the military?
Yeah.
So that's why.
Yeah.
So you think that they were actually ordered to destroy that material from something else outside the military, normal military chain of command?
Yeah. Well, you'd have to be a pretty big fellow to order General Vandenberg around. You'd have to be a very tough big fella to give him orders. He was already in 46 a brigadier general and heading to be head of the Air Force.
Right.
Commander-in-chief of the American Air Force. And you don't boss that kind of guy, tell him what to do, give him orders very easily.
Well, there's only two people who are over them, and that would be the President of the United States or the CIA. Or national, well, they didn't have a national security advisor at that time, but it'd be, those are the two.
It's a matter of tactics. If the president, namely Truman, ordered this to be destroyed, then it could have been far more easily destroyed than asking the chief of staff of the Air Force to destroy it himself.
Right. Because the reason why I'm asking this, because while reading in your book, and I want to get into it, because it was really interesting when it gets into the UFO activity in 1952, which I wanted you to get in pretty in-depth with, but all of a sudden Truman, you know, waking up, seeing the flying, you know, the UFOs and all the activity going around, and then he was freaking out, and he immediately took the information from, you know, what was happening from the Air Force, and it's basically, okay, that's fine, Danny, I'm going to have the CIA deal with it. That was his answer, it seemed like. And basically, that's where it went.
Well, it was Truman who got the CIA involved. President Truman.
Mm-hmm. Basically, that's what I'm thinking of. From your research in this book, is there any other intelligence agency other than the CIA that you saw within the what was going on that may have been another governmental agency involved with sabotaging and creating, you know, basically the demise of Rupert and the Blue Book investigations?
Well, Blue Book was finally destroyed. After Rupert left the Air Force, remember he was an enlisted man, and he left the Air Force at the end of the Korean War, and he wrote a book called The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, which was the book he wrote, and which I wrote my book as a description of this book. After Rupert left, the Blue Book was reduced to a one-man part-time operation in charge of Major Quintilla. And all Major Quintilla did was to just burn the project to the ground. He didn't do any investigations, as all reports were ignored, and the files of Blue Book were put away in a dusty storehouse. This was a preparation for the United States Air Force to finally destroy all UFO investigations in 1968, when they instituted the Condon Report. Professor Condon had meetings and analyses and concluded that UFOs in 1968, were nonsense, imagination, fantasies, mistakes, and therefore.
But that was in 1968. But wasn't there another thing that they followed under? I thought it was in the 50s. The Brookings Institute gave a study for the government, the reasoning behind supposedly that they were going to keep the public away from the knowledge and understanding of UFO activity because of the fear that the people would have. That was the Brookings Institute report. That I thought that's what they utilized for their reasoning behind not letting the non-disclosure of their investigations. Is that
well? The Brookings Institute could at that time in 68 could do whatever it liked. But it was a private organization, remember?
No.
When the Air Force declared, made an official declaration that the UFO was dead, there wasn't much the Brookings Institute could do about it.
No. I was saying the Brookings. You didn't understand. The Brookings Institute came out, did a study on behalf of for the government, gave the reasoning in the 50s. I can't remember the year it was. I know it was in the 50s. That.
I'm sorry. I'm getting your perspective now. I do apologize.
Yeah. You didn't understand what I was saying. I said the Brookings Institute report was in the 50s on order from the government, and
yes,
that's.
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. And then, but the what I was trying to get to, okay, I know what I want to ask you, because a lot of people out there, I know you were mentioning Blue Book constantly, and I'm actually getting some texts from emails from some people. They want what out of the Blue Book? What percentage of activity of UFOs was substantiated, that they are actually questionable? Unidentified flying objects and the possibility of being extraterrestrial.
Well, there were lots and lots of utterly fantastic cases of experienced people seeing solid objects which did not appear to be of this earth. The social spectrum of observations varied from highly qualified bomber and fighter pilots, down to farmers, housewives shopping, the whole and entire social spectrum of America put forward statistically UFO reports. The intellectual problem here is that similar spectra could be observed in almost every country in the globe, of the globe. And so you've got a difficult problem. You could trash the American reports, but trashing the reports from Australia, Great Britain, France, Germany is a different matter, a very difficult problem in trashing there. Excuse me. And if you read my book and Ruppelt's book, you will see. Sorry, I'm just going to cough a moment. Excuse me. You will see that there are the most fantastic sightings coming in of solid objects. Radar contact. Sightings from military bases by means of advanced technical equipment. And a general consensus at this time that here was something mysterious indeed. These objects performed maneuvers which were not performable by any aerofoil at this time. They outpaced bombers and fighters the best and looped the loop in front of them, ran rings around them, went into the Mach 3 area with ease, and because then there were no supersonic fighters in 53.
Right.
They shaped many fighters, Sabres, and F-94s tried to give chase to these strange discs, and almost as if the discs were aware of the chase, they went ahead straight into Mach 3 region with no problem. Another problem is there were no sonic booms. So you have a big intellectual problem here. What kind of material can go through into Mach 3? From standing start, mind you.
Yeah, that was sort of
without,
obvious.
Without a sonic boom.
Yeah, well, that's because we still are limiting our we don't apply the it's because I think we apply the physics of Newtonian physics and not applying Einstein quantum physics, and which is in the reality of utilization of time and space and energy. But that's because, they're thinking more of material and stuff like that. This is
one of the fascinating things about ufology. It leads you into the areas that you've just mentioned.
Yeah, well, that's what I. It's amazing that you, because that's where I see. That's what's interesting. I think if you the dynamics. I've seen several people who do investigations and actually seen actual extraterrestrials is all over Facebooks and everybody can see them. But one of my question to you, just in percentage wise, because this is what some people were asking, off the Blue Book, they're saying that even if there was 5% the UFOs for real, not jokes or crazy people or whatever, 5% was real, that 5% of reality is something to talk about. If you have one event out of a million, that one ship lands on the middle of the lawn in the White House, that's one out of a million that's a reality. You understand what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
So what percentage would you say was in the UFO? Because I think there was a percentage, but I don't recall if you knew it, that they could substantiate that they really are considered unidentified objects and could possibly be extraterrestrial. There is a percentage, I believe, isn't there?
Well, I personally believe that these objects, I don't know what they are. I don't profess to know what they are. But these are objects, excuse me, in maneuvering in Earth's atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
That's my belief. If only because I have seen one myself. And once you see one of these things, I've only seen one, but once you see just one, you're convinced that they're not of this Earth. I know a lot about science, mathematics, engineering, technology, and in my experience, that I saw something that was in what you might call the very, very, very fast lane. It couldn't have been manufactured by Earth technology, the current state of Earth technology.
Well, you know
and
what?
I have only seen one, mind you. I'm not a freak. I don't tell you that the aliens are in the White House. No, but I tell you, I've seen one. And it was the most incredible experience in my life. A mere observation, mind you. Not abductions or exopolitics or aliens on the White House lawn or anything like that. Once you see one, plain, simple, in the air above your head, you know that they're real.
Yeah, well, let me just say, and I've never really discussed this actually on the radio, so this is the first time we do. People know about it because I've talked to it personally. I shot a film with a partner of mine in a documentary with the Hopi in the mesas in Arizona. And out of that, we had two major experiences. One was we had a light that was sitting there following us along the mesas while we're driving, and we were like sort of weird. It was like an orangish light following us, a ball. When we left and we finally completed our shoot and we were leaving the mesas on the way through Flagstaff, on the way to back to L.A., there was an unusual cloud pattern. And we had a triangle ship come right above my car in front of us. It had a green, like, weird light coming off of it. And it was like the cloud opened. It came right above us. As we're driving, it was like keeping our distance from where we're driving. And we were like, what the hell? And we didn't drink. We didn't do anything. We just, and this is two of us seeing the same thing. And then all of a sudden, the thing went, it went up and then like dissolved in the air within the cloud. The cloud like opened up and closed within it. It was like almost like a vacuum. And we just looked at ourselves like, what the shit? Then we thought, well, I guess we did a good thing with the film we shot. This is the first time I'm telling this on the air because I've been around and had feelings about extraterrestrial activities. I even wrote a book way back when I didn't even tell you back in 2000 when I wrote this book, and I had no clue that there are other people who thought about extraterrestrials like what you wrote. I had absolutely no knowledge of it until I started doing the radio circuit. And all of a sudden, I find out, oh, I'm not the only one who thought the same thing. So, what I find really fascinating right now, which I don't understand, is now people, I know within the United States, they did a Gallup poll. They show over 60% of the population in the United States now believe that there's extraterrestrials that are actually have been or involved with our societies. And I think more and more is being disclosed with every moment. And with what you're putting in the book, just it's just like, you know, it tells you the mentality of yesteryears in the 50s, how people lived. It just reminds me, when I started reading this, I started realizing, wait, this is back in the 50s. You know, your book remind me, Rupert? Kurt Vonnegut's Breakfast of Champions.
Yes.
And Rupert was the lone guy who got screwed at the end. But and people shouldn't read this book, because one thing you see an average guy go through this, and what's really sad about this, after all the stuff, they really put him through the run mill, and he died like 8 years later of a heart attack. And you can see, if I had a picture, I don't know if I've seen pictures of him, but I can imagine he probably had developed an ailment at the end of the years, and it would, you know, it just, you know, they actually, from the stress and everything of putting him through the ring mill, I think they literally killed him mentally, you know, physically and emotionally, you know. That's what it seems like. You broke him. Now, there was a space of time, and then another thing I was going to bring up, during the 50s, another thing you have to realize, this is during the communist scare. So people, I know the media, because there's an event, which I want you to talk about right now, that came out about the UFO activity on the eastern side. So people are aware, during the 50s, you know, we had the communist scare, but the same token, you know, with the Russians and stuff, the Russians had overestimated our ability, what we can actually do, and we overestimated what the Russians can do, okay?
Yes.
This is a fact. We thought that the Russians had this heavy, massive force, they're just going to throw all the, just obliterate the United States and the Western world, and that's what we thought. And they thought we had highly efficient military that could just, you know, knock out ships. We had jets all over the place. There's like no way they're going to come on continental United States, until you read what happened on the White House, where people go 9/11 when we didn't even knock down that, which is a whole other story. I think it's more like the conspiracies are not a conspiracy, but reality. But our incompetence of not having the ability to protect the Western side of the United States against any even attack. You could came onto the United States with a 1920 airplane and dropped a bomb on the White House even at that time, and there was no protection. That's how retarded our military was in the 50s. And literally, we had nothing, and yet the Soviets thought we had this massive defensive umbrella to protect the continental United States, which was not a truth. So given that fact... Can you tell us the story of what happened at the White House? And this is a true story, with all the activity that happened in 1952 that literally became the thing that sounded off what happened and unfortunately became the demise of Rupert's investigation.
Well, on July the 19th, 1952, which was a Saturday, first of all, let me give you the Washington air base situation. Washington, at that time, had three airfields. The first was Washington National Airport, which, of course, was civilian. There were two military Air Force bases. One was Bolling Air Force Base, and the other one was Andrews Air Force Base, which was a base for an F-94 night fighter squadron, which provided, or was supposed to provide, air cover for the capital of America. On July the 19th, 1952, seven objects, about 11 o'clock at night, 11:30 at night, seven objects, glowing orbs, approached the National Airport and was caught on three radars from the three bases I just mentioned. The lights were I had a very strange behavior. Some were too slow to be any jet aircraft. There were no jet aircraft in the vicinity, and their speed was far too low for jets or even four-engined airliners such as the Convair, Constellation, which was in general use at the time. There was no air activity at 11:30 in those days because traffic was down compared to what it is today. And the traffic controller of Washington National Airport, Howard Barnes, I think that's his name, Barnes, thought the situation, this was the Cold War, remember, and Howard Barnes thought the situation was such that he had to summon Andrews Air Force Base for interceptors to get into the sky and see what these lights were. Andrews Air Force Base, in one of the great puzzles of history, told Barnes there were no fighters available at Andrews Air Force Base because the runway was being dug up. Can you beat that? So Barnes decides to summon fighters from, I think it was in Newark Air Force Base, 100 miles away. And after some considerable delay, mind you, one F-94 arrives, but you can't see anything. The lights switch off as if you've switched off a light bulb. Then they get three radar lock-on to material objects which they can't see. The radar from Boeing, the radar from Andrews Air Force Base, and the radars from the Washington National Airport locked on to solid objects which they couldn't see. And that was on the weekend of the first, what they call the Washington invasion. Are they coming over loud and clear there? Am I loud and clear?
Yeah, I hear you. Go ahead. Keep on going. Go ahead.
Okay. At this time, it so happened that Captain Ruppelt was on a visit from Dayton, Ohio, to Washington on various administrative missions. He could have looked out of his hotel room and actually seen the damn things. These orbs, of course, at half past 11 at night, were seen by the whole of the evening Washington concourse. People poured out of cafes, restaurants, theaters, clubs, everything, to look at these strange maneuvering lights right above the Capitol building. Photographs were taken of them. Cats and dogs in the street must have seen them, but the Air Force didn't see them. It didn't know anything about it. How about this? There was complete intelligence, blindness, and inactivity on behalf of the United States Air Force. People phoned the Air Force. Honeymoon couples took photographs, which you could still see, of these orbs, and yet the Air Force didn't know anything, didn't want to know anything, a complete no of an answer to any and every inquiry. They'd seen nothing, and they were not interested in talking to people who had seen nothing. They said they'd seen nothing. It's a kind of cultural question mark, or a whole series of cultural question marks, where honeymoon couples in parks see the damn things, and thousands of other people see the damn things, yet the United States Air Force saw nothing. One begins to suspect that there's a plot here somewhere.
Yeah, sounds and sort of like a little Fellini, like somebody's trying to put a little act here. But and then the funniest thing was these UFOs woke up and scared the shit out of President Truman.
Yeah. The newspapers had headlines 2 inches high the next morning. They stopped the presses for the evening news and put this UFO news right across. A half a dozen major Washington newspapers put it there. And Truman, so much was alive to this, of course, when he over his breakfast coffee. And I always admired Truman for what he did next. It showed that there was something about him that got him the presidency of America. You know, people put Truman down. You know, he was a little gross from a man, nothing to be compared with the glamorous Kennedys. Yet what he did next was good. He told his heir attaché, Brigadier General, to phone guess who? Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, I'll just go back on that one. Brigadier General Landry, to phone guess who? Ruppelt, directly, yeah. Notice that the President of America didn't go to the Air Force staff. He didn't go to the Air Force commander. He didn't go to the high intelligence branches of air intelligence. He went to Ruppelt. And he didn't go personally, but Landry took the phone call for him. And Ruppelt gave a report to the president's air attaché. And duly, Landry submitted this report. Truman, when he read this report, was so alarmed, indeed, and fascinated, that he next did a thing perhaps he shouldn't have done. He informed the CIA, he told the CIA to analyze this phenomenon, because he thought it was real and it was worthy of top-level analysis by the CIA. Now, from that moment on, in 52, bookshelves have groaned and broken with the number of books written on the CIA's involvement with the UFO. I'm not going to go into that now, but conspiracy theories have had a honeymoon for many years over CIA involvement. It was Truman's initiative that brought that in, yes. We're talking about the Washington sightings of July the 19th, Saturday into Sunday of 1952.
Can I ask you a question? When is the Area 51 became established? Because I know Patterson was since the 50s dealing with, since the days what you just talked about. When did Area 51 come into the pattern of dealing with extraterrestrials or UFO or who knows what that you're aware of?
Well, Go ahead. Yep.
I was saying to you, since we know the Blue Book and all that stuff was happening in the early 50s, when did Area 51 come into light of doing their whatever activity they were doing? Because we know
The term Area 51 is a very, very late term to be developed. There was an experimental area in the area called 1951. The first thing I want to say is that there's a very, very good book written by a woman whose name I just can't remember. It's appeared recently about how she thinks that a lot of UFO reports at this time were reports of Area 51 type prototype aircraft. Well, first of all, Area 51 prototypes of 1952 we're not capable of the performances, to say the least. We'd only just left the propeller engine era into jet engines. We were into the jet engine, jet age. And as say, you know, Jaeger could tell us, no, this is the time that Tom Wolfe called the right stuff of enormous confidence in American jets and their power. They would have limited performance. There were no supersonic jets at this time. In squadron service, that is. There was one, the Bellwex 1, but that only Jaeger could fly that.
And there was a Canadian, I think they called it the Arrow or something like that, that came out in the early 50s that broke the Mach 1. That was the first time they
I think the Bellwex 1 did. Jaeger flew it. But, I mean, we're talking about a highly experimental prototype here, and that... It never got near to squadron service. There were no supersonic aircraft in squadron service in 1952. The F-94, the humble aircraft by modern standards, it could get to about 650 miles an hour and nowhere near Mach 1. But anyway, she propose as a situation which I find, even though the book's a very good book, that I find I cannot accept. One, that there's a fast lane in techno industry and a slow lane. Now, if there's a fast lane, as she suggests, that enormously advanced exotic aircraft design were flying around in 1952, and yet we were struggling to get to Mach 1 in the slow lane. Okay, am I understood by slow lane and fast lane here? The slow lane, we were struggling to get to Mach 1. In the fast lane, she proposes aircraft that just go to Mach 5. They were developing one or two things, such as Blackbird and Oxcart at Area 51, but that was much later, and they were so expensive you couldn't have more than one or two of them. And they're certainly so expensive with titanium machined fuselage. Can you imagine that? Titanium, how much that must cost? They were much later than the Ruppelt period. And certainly the government, we're talking about the government here rather than the Air Force, wouldn't allow them to stooge around at Washington or New York or any other city. They made such a sound, they would split citizens' eardrums. So it's difficult for me to believe that UFOs were mistaken reports of American prototypes. So that's my opinion.
Yeah, so like it's sort of absurd because I know what you're talking about because I've read that, not just a book, but people even today say, well, you know, all the UFO activity, you know, these, I'm talking about people who are cynical and trying to be the, you know, questioning UFO activity or whatever. So all those are really just, you know, it's like a stealth bomber and all this technology. That they can just—that's what people think are UFOs are really just special technology that's used by the United States, for example, or whatever. The only thing, the problem with that is, if that were so true, how come it's all over Mexico, Brazil, the Middle East, Australia, Africa, Europe? I mean, are they doing all these special flight patterns all around the world for their testing at the same time?
Exactly. It's a ludicrous thesis.
Yeah,
a very good book by a brilliant woman, but one which I think is, with great respect to you, ma'am, is nonsense.
Yeah, well, I think they take a... You know, they're taking what they, a lot of people do is, and this is what I find even through research of people, they actually take opinions and they turn those opinions into facts, which are not facts. They also speculate on things, and they come with a formula of what they do in science, like what they say, like in quantum physics. I already know my result and what the result I want. So what I'll do is make an experiment to achieve to my result that I want. So what?
You're imposing a solution of your own. Yeah.
Right. So and in fact, so the means justifies the ends. So that's how a lot of people do that. You're talking about books. I've seen people in politics and. From Huffington Post things, I've seen postings, and I argue with people about certain situations politically. They do the same thing. Instead of having an overview of really stepping out of the picture and looking at things. That's why I say a lot of people stand out. And actually, if you were an extraterrestrial and you come to our society and you look at humanity for the first time, that is what humanity really is. The same token, when you look at what you're talking about with extraterrestrial activity or UFOs, happening things, step out of the picture, look from the outside in, and look in the phenomena like what every culture has that's consistent through this thing of UFO activity isn't just happened now. It hasn't happened since the 50s. It's been going on for thousands of years, and you know, and now it's coming out through the things with Van Daniken and Georgios Sokolos and a lot of others with the ancient aliens thing and showing the connection from Egyptian to Sumerian to Chinese to ancient Israel to...
Oh, yeah, well, yeah.
to Mayans to... You know, and this is what I'm finding out. My own research is doing because I deal with the esoterics, which I find that this is
John,
my...
would you excuse me for 30 seconds? I have to close this door, okay?
No problem.
Philomena! Would you close this door, please?
This is called live radio.
Okay. 3, 2, 1, I'm with you again.
Right. But I what I like what you did is in this book is show a personal view of this person who out of history it seems like 20, 30 years have passed, or actually now 50 years, over 50, 60 years, and he didn't really get the just acknowledgement for what he was. I mean, it's funny you call him a hero, but he was just basically, I think, a situation of time. Of circumstance, and he happened to be one of those who happened to be caught in the crossfire of of those who went down with the ship, because they were the ship of understanding UFO and being disclosed was purposely sabotaged, and he happened to be the captain on it at that time, and that so went down the ship. Let me ask you this, Colin. Are you in right now writing any new phenomena or any new books or coming out regarding UFO activity?
Yeah, I'm writing on scientists and UFOs. Scientists and UFOs.
And when do you expect that to come out?
Well, I'm halfway through it. I expect it to be out just before Christmas.
Oh, wow. I look forward to that. Let me ask you this. I want everybody to, because we have to close right now. Colin, I want to thank you for coming on my show. I sat back because I wanted you just basically tell the story. I only threw my, tried to do my spiel just because I was getting questioned by a lot of people asking questions. But the people, everybody, it's a real, it's a really quick book, actually. I read it, actually, in 2 days. It's called Flying Saucers Over the White House, The Inside Story of Captain Edward J. Ruppelt and His Official U.S. Air Force Investigation of UFOs. There's a lot of information. It has a great introduction. It also explains a lot of the aeronautical history within the space industries in the United States, and they're actually at the world at that time. Which I thought was pretty educational, if you want to know about that. But I highly recommend it. It really makes you really think about what happened during the 50s. You have to realize back in the 50s, that was the days where, you know, there was the things were happening that you would never think of today, where people had the Red Scare, they throw you in jail just thinking that you might be socialist, communist. There were people who lost jobs at that time. Blacklisted, and a lot of things happened during that time. We went in, there was a start of the first time the United States went into a war that was undeclared. There was the emergence of the CIA, and look where that has gotten us. And it was the first time actually in history, which you brought up within your book, which is pretty phenomenal, that we never really, there were no patents, there were no Bradley's or even Eisenhower's or anybody of competence who ran our military from that point on, from since the World War II, even through Vietnam, and I personally think even till to this day, we haven't really had in the United States a really that kind of caliber of people leading our the military, and you bring that out, which I think was well put. I mean, an example of that, look at the Iraq War, example of that, Afghanistan. Look how many people get killed for bullshit. But besides besides the reasons why we got in there, look how even the military went into Iraq with a blitzkrieg Israeli, German style going through there, and they didn't even have recon units to pick up any, all the war material that would be left behind that somebody else, insurgents, could utilize. So it shows how incompetent their military was, the United States, the British, even in Iraq, even to this day, where they have to kill a half a million civilians just to topple one little government, or actually more. How many? I think it was 1 million civilians. But I want to thank you for coming on my show. It was
thank you. It's been a pleasure.
honor to have you on the show, and I look forward to your book. And everybody, go get his book. It's a great book. And again, thank you, everybody. And this will be an archive, so anything you have missed, it should be hopefully by sometime this weekend. Check it out if you missed anything. And God bless you all, and have a glorious weekend. Thank you, and thank you, Colin, for coming on my show.